Welcome to our most recent podcast series, Collective Intelligence. At a moment when the shape of work is being redrawn, we seek to explore the magic that happens when groups perform at more than the sum of their parts. A theme we researched extensively in our book, The Social Brain, The Psychology of Successful Groups. It's such a pleasure to welcome Margaret Heffernan to Collective Intelligence. Margaret's a professor of practice at Bath University, CEO mentor, an entrepreneur, best-selling author, keynote speaker, and a long-time collaborator of Thomson Harrison and Oxford. But I'm looking forward to talking to her today about her exciting new book, Hot Off the Press, Embracing Uncertainty, How Writers, Musicians, and Artists Thrive in an Unpredictable World. So welcome, Margaret. It's wonderful to have you. And I thought we could just pile straight in, and I kick off by asking you, what was the spark that got you beginning to write this book?
Well, I think it was similar to the spark that gave rise to my previous books, in the sense that I started to hear something or to notice something. And having noticed it once or twice, I then started to look and listen for it and started noticing it everywhere. And actually, one of the places I first noticed this was in one of your fantastic events in Oxford, where, as you may or may not recall, there was a discussion about how very well-educated, well-credentialed young people coming into work lacked a sense of agency, were kind of paralyzed by ambiguity, and lacked creative competence. I mean, it's something I had been noticing, but I was kind of blown away by the degree to which, when I raised the topic, everybody was just enthusiastically nodding their heads. And that just sort of started a snowball effect where I just kept testing this on people and seeing it over and over and over again. And eventually, you know, other things conspired to drive it. But I started to think, okay, this is a real thing. Nobody's talking about it, but I think it's not only real, but I think it's really, really important in an age of so much uncertainty, when we need creativity more than ever, to start looking at what is it, why are we not developing it, how could we develop it, and how do we explain to people who may not be comfortable in what they see as a creative space, how do we explain to them this is something we're all capable of, we were all born with, and we can all get better at?
I would like to come back to talking about education, because I know I read your article in the FT yesterday about it, and I know you've got some strong thoughts about that, as do I. But I'd like to, you know, as you mention Oxford, I mean, both you and I have spent a lot of our careers supporting, talking to, helping leaders. The irony, of course, is if you are truly leading, you are orientating yourself right into uncertainty because you're facing the future. And yet, you know, as we design leadership programs or help leaders, I know that there is so much more that one could learn, for example, from an improv artist than from learning how to do spreadsheets better. And yet there is such a reluctance to go for things that are hard to measure, perhaps. And we probably have five times as many people asking us, how can we do spreadsheets better, than, oh my goodness, how do we deal with uncertainty, and how can we think differently about it? Why do we find it so difficult to value what's hard to measure?
Well, I think in the last 20 years or so, I think economics has kind of eaten our brains. It's as though we really can't imagine anything is important if you don't have a measurement for it. You know, we've been sold this notion that data equals knowledge. Well, data doesn't equal knowledge. It equals something. But data is not knowledge per se until you start using it to create knowledge. So I think the fact that it's impossible to say this book is better than that book, this painting is better than that painting, because one has a score of 6.13 and one has a score of 6.13. So, you know, you asked about the spark for this book. Well, you know, one of my bugbears is a business book I read, which shall remain nameless because I hate being mean about other writers. You know, King Lear would have been deemed Shakespeare's worst play at the beginning of the 20th century because it really nobody performed it very much at all after his death to make it the play. Now, the play hadn't changed. We had. And so the value of art is not intrinsic to the thing itself. It is some alchemy between the work and the context in which it is experienced. So it is really intrinsically unmeasurable. Everything that matters will be measured, and therefore anything that can't be measured obviously doesn't matter. Combined with, you know, a grotesquely oversimplified notion that it's just science, technology, engineering, and mathematics that matter anymore to anybody anywhere, I think we have casually and expensively overlooked one of the greatest human capacities that we've had since we walked the earth.
I mean, you put it so beautifully. I mean, goodness, our human capacity for imagination, for just what we're doing now to communicate conceptually, you know, it's as if, as you say, we've turned away from it. And I'd like to come back to your earlier reference to education and the focus on STEM. I mean, back 100 years ago, I taught in high school, taught English. I was really shocked that a local school to us in Oxford that used to have four sets of kids doing English A-level, quite recently it's down to just one small set of people. And I think we also experience this on our leadership programs, where we often use, as you well know, you know, case studies from plays, or I find if we put a paintbrush into the hand of a CEO, there's an expression of embarrassment, you know, sort of fear, worry, bewilderment, and no sense of how this could connect to what they do. And back to your point about younger people, I know quite a few humanities, you know, PhDs who are working as baristas. I mean, I wonder whether you have a sense, Margaret, because you're a person of action. What can we do? And what is there even a first step that needs to be taken?
Well, I think the very first step is to recognize that people who read art subjects or liberal arts subjects at university, a vanishingly small number of those people go on to become artists. One of my new best friends, by a sort of gorgeous coincidence, is Eliza Manningham Buller, who, you know, is an English graduate. She thought she would one day head up MI5 and later the Wellcome Trust. But I know she would say that the capacity to understand narrative and be able to communicate and think hard about what people mean when they're talking gave her many of the most crucial skills in her very successful career. So I think part of it is we are making a classic mistake, which is an uncertainty to jobs. And the result of that is that we have people who are highly unadaptive in a world that is demanding of huge adaptation to change, and to believe that their one core competence is all that they need in life, where we know we need every creative capacity that we're capable of. I mean, let's not forget, you know, before there was STEM, before there was engineering, the human race created the world we now see today out of pure agency, necessity, and creativity. That was it. That's what got us out of caves, you know. So this is a pretty phenomenal native latent skill that we have. And it kind of defies imagination to think that we would regard it as disposable. But that's kind of what is happening in much education and in much recruiting, you know, and it kind of goes both ways, you know, that the subjects decline at schools because parents have been persuaded that, oh no, all their kids absolutely have to become hardcore mathematicians. So we've seen a retrenchment, not just from the activities that feed our soul, but from the core human competences, which are specifically what we need in an age where technology may take over some of the more specific skills. I mean, it's very interesting saying that, you know, in 2 or 3 years, most jobs writing code will be gone. What are all those poor computer scientists supposed to do? They didn't get any more competence in their education because they thought this was their passport to riches.
I was going to say exactly that, Margaret. You know, the irony is, of course, technology is fantastic at modeling at the mathematical side of things. Where it's not so brilliant is the embodied, the imaginative, the kind of the dreaming of the future side of things, which is what we are brilliant at. I studied English at university as well, and you're right. I mean, I felt that I was plunged into, you know, endless human scenarios that allowed you to sort of plunge yourself and live into, you know, how human beings behave under pressure or, you know, in all sorts of different. It was an amazing education for what I'm doing now in terms of, you know, really thinking about leadership. Another thing that struck me from your book was I loved the way you wrote about artists as well and, you know, how they notice the world. I actually had a conversation with my husband a day or so ago, and I said, when was the moment when the first thing we did, which is when we wake up, is reach for our phones? I mean, what has happened to our attention? What has happened to, and when did we change? And I wonder if there's anything you could pass on about that you learned from those artists about how we can, you know, how we can retrain our attention or notice the world more rigorously and be the better for it.
Certainly all the interviews that I did definitely persuaded me of the value of being where you are. Right, not walking down the street on your phone, headphones in, but really regarding any walk to the office or whatever it might be as an opportunity to pick up signals about what's going on in the world. I mean, much more subtle, but just as important as reading the news, much less generic. You know, what's the mood? How are people looking? You know, what are the colors this season? What's going on out there? Because all business takes place within a context. And if you have to understand the business and help it to be successful is as much about what's going on outside the business as inside the business. But to the degree that you stick to your phone and to your, you know, your work publications and documents and memos and spreadsheets, all you're seeing is the world inside your bubble. That's a single voice, if you like. It isn't any kind of dialogue. It isn't going to be a very fertile area in which to see what other people aren't seeing, in which to have a sense of where are we. Don't read the newspaper, I mean, that's fine. But I don't think that that's going to provoke as many reflections as having a sense of where am I? What's going on? How are people feeling? What are they talking about? I mean, I am an inveterate earwigger, I should confess. But it just gives me the ability to tune into the world. And one of the big problems that people, especially people in positions of power, have is that everybody knows what they think they want to. But actually, to understand the world, you need to be able to see the things that you might not want to hear. And some of this, you know, train of thought on my part really was precipitated by the conversation I had with Andy Haldane many years ago, where I remember he told me that often he would just leave his office and go and walk around the city of London. This is when he was chief of economics of England, just to get a feel for what's going on. And I thought, okay, well, if an economist takes this stuff seriously, well, maybe the rest of us should too.
There's a common theme that kind of runs almost across all your musicians and artists and writers, which is one of bringing themselves into real relationship with the world and through intense curiosity. And I wondered, We often use journals or create commonplace books for our leadership programs. We ask people to write with handwriting, to be kind of analog, to actually make concrete their thoughts and to, you know, gather together the stuff that comes out of a program. And I wondered, just to ask you personally, rather than to read your interviews, how you found the process of writing, and I know you've written many books and plays, changes the way you think.
Yes, that is a very, very, very wise observation. I would say every book I've written has changed the way I've thought. I think this book has probably changed the way I write more than many, partly because I have this sort of feeling that if you're writing about a wonderful art, you better bloody well do it well, you know? So I felt much more determined to make how the book reads as careful as what it says. And probably the most obvious way in which I did that was after I wrote the first draft, I felt it was too linear. And I thought, you know, it's in the nature of complexity out of which uncertainty comes, that it's not, that complexity is nonlinear. And so I took the very deliberate decision to put the interludes between chapters, which breaks up the linearity of the argument, because I thought the book needs to be what the argument is talking about. And I think, you know, most people have said to me they really love it because it's a gear change and it's a really refreshing gear change. But it was a very deliberate attempt to write differently. I mean, the other thing I would say is I discovered how unbelievably difficult it is to write about music. I mean, I think the sections about Miles Davis, about Shostakovich, about Mahler, probably gave me more trouble than anything else in the book, to be honest. But, you know, I've been writing long enough to know that if it's really difficult, that means I'm learning something, and then I just crack on.
Yeah, I mean, that point about form and content, by the way, I love the way you broke up the chapters. I thought it worked brilliantly, and that we don't think enough about form. We don't think enough about dynamics, I don't think. We tend to be focused always on content. And one of the images quite early on in your book, where you talk, there's a sad image of the dancing bears of Bulgaria, where you said, when they were finally released into the wild from their captivity, from this, you know, forced dancing for people, they continued to dance because it was all they knew. And I wondered to link that with, you know, the fact that here you and I are, you know, in this square screen, magical. You're probably in Bath, I'm in Norfolk. There are magical things about it. But I wonder whether the form of how we are increasingly engaged, hour after hour after hour after hour, is changing the structure of our thought and making dancing bears of us all, that actually once we close that screen, we're still constrained in the way we think, in the way we kind of structure how we approach the world. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think it's, if I may say so, a typically wise insight. I remember at one point during the pandemic when, as well as using Zoom and such tools to keep our work going, we also used it to stay in touch with friends and family. And I started to notice that even if I was chatting to a friend in the United States, for example, very good old friend in this case, she sort of basically stopped after an hour. And I thought, but it's not that kind of thing. I think that the degree to which all the tools we use at work, we also use for the rest of our lives, instead of making our lives more relaxed and integrated, it has actually made our non-work lives more like work. And of course, the self-help industry has contributed to this massively in terms of telling everybody to, you know, how to be fantastically efficient, how to be a great time manager, how to manage your downtime, how to manage your love life, you know, all using basically business frameworks for doing this. And I think we have become kind of like the dancing bears. I think it's exceptionally difficult to say to people, okay, we're going to go for a walk. There is no destination. We can walk as long or as little as we want. We can stop when we want to. There is no agenda. We're just hanging out. I use in the book also the example of a friend of mine who, planning a weekend break in Barcelona, planned every minute of it, did all the research, you know, down to the minute, virtually, you know, the best hotels, the best restaurants, the most important sites, the right tickets for the right shows, all this stuff. And I thought, you know, you don't even have to bother going now. You have so scheduled yourself out of seeing anything afresh or any fortuitous accident. And yet we know that when we go traveling, you know, what are the things we remember best? The accident. You know, the accidental popping into a shop because it was raining and discovering, you know, a lovely sweater, or the accidental conversation we had with really nice people who were sitting at the table next to us, or because the order got mixed up, tasting something we hadn't expected to taste before. You know, we are so anxious about uncertainty that we're at risk of making our lives so certain as to be stale, uninteresting, predictable, and just like everybody else's.
I know how you talk about that word efficient and efficiency. I often take that word deliberately and will say to a chief executive or a group, the most efficient thing you can do is to get people telling stories or to work, I don't know, with an improv artist. Or I deliberately use that word because I absolutely believe it, that if you can connect in a human level up front, if you can drop your shoulders, laugh together, be curious together, learn together, that down the line when you're doing the most complicated financial thing or whatever, you are so well equipped to be efficient in how you work together. We're nearly at the end, but I've got three more questions. I've got tons of questions I would like to ask you, but three more questions. I was so heartened years ago when Mary Robinson, you know, ex-president of Ireland, had Seamus Heaney, the wonderful poet Seamus Heaney, as her advisor. And you think, goodness, now in 2025, you look at political leaders and you think, who would even think of having a poet or a playwright or a musician as an advisor, as a source of wisdom? And how did we get here? I mean, we're covering the same ground we've talked about before, but I wonder, you know, just as a sort of thought experiment, if you were Keir Starmer, I won't say Donald Trump, but if you're Keir Starmer, I mean, and you could pick some wisdom from the wonderful people that you've interviewed, who do you think would make great advisors to policymakers and people who are trying to lead the world at the moment?
I mean, it's a wonderful question, and it reminds me that the government of Singapore runs some of the best scenario planning in the world. And one of the things I'm really struck by is they always involve artists in that, always. Now, I don't think anybody would accuse the Singaporean government of being frivolous. You know, they do it for a reason, because artists are sort of super sensors of what's going on in the world. And Heaney, of course, you know, had a very specific view of art, which was that its job was to provide glimpsed alternatives to what one saw, obviously, and to create a dialogue in his poetry between the glimpsed alternative and the present reality. And it's exactly what art does. He's, as usual, very articulate on that topic. So if I think of, you know, of some of the artists who are in the book, I guess my first thought would go to Peter Kennard, Britain's foremost protest artist, I had the incredible good luck of being shown around a huge retrospective of his work at the Whitechapel Gallery by him, and understanding that what he regularly does in his work is put two opposite images together to see what they produce. So I think having that kind of habit of mind would be very helpful to Keir Starmer, who I think, like many people, feels an obligation to act more certain and stay on one path, not using the freedom that he really does have. So I think Kennard would be a fantastic example. One of the other people I write about, Josette Bushell-Mingo, who just does this astounding, absolutely unbelievable one-woman show about Nina Simone, has a lot of bravery in terms of what she's prepared to say and see, I think could be a great provider of counter-narratives. Or not even counter-narratives, but narratives that are richer than data, I think is really important. I would say the same of the poet Paul Muldoon and the late Derek Matten. I mean, both fantastic poets. I think it's really crucial for people in fundamental decision-making roles to have people around who think very differently from them. And by that, I mean not just party political differences, but whose experience of life and ongoing experiences of life are organized in completely different ways, which allows them to see completely different things. I mean, I'm thinking again of Anne Hardy, who's a Turner Prize nominee, and indeed of Rory Pilgrim. I mean, these two people have such exceptional observational skills, and they pay so much very delicate attention to the small things that really count, that I think they have a lot to say to anybody charged with making big decisions.
You talked about King Lear right at the beginning of this conversation. You know, he had his fool to be a truth teller, to speak truth to power. And, you know, that sort of metaphor, maybe you've put together a little cabinet for Keir Starmer in this conversation. That would be great if that happened. I've only got two more questions, and we're here to talk about your book, not our book. But as you know, we became interested in what doesn't change about human behavior. I mean, so much of work is focused on what does change and how, you know, how people can work with the grain of human behavior rather than against it, which so often happens. And as reading your book and thinking about the artists you describe, you know, we were very interested in the influence of sort of evolutionary psychology and those images in the caves of, I don't know if you remember them, the handprints in Argentina from sort of 10,000 years ago. And this sort of sense anyway that spoke to me of, you know, the need for ritual, the need for collective artistic expression, that is just something that doesn't change in human beings. And I'm just marrying that with what we read about everywhere, which is loneliness, people being, you know, unhappy, depressed. I wonder what you learned. You know, I read about the wonderful para orchestra, you know, ensembles, ateliers, the kind of social power, the connective, collaborative power of the arts and the humanities, and whether you can talk to us just a little bit in this last few minutes about, you know, the social benefits of of art.
So I think the social benefits of art are just gigantic. I see this all the time. I'm very interested, as you know, in the growth of things like painting workshops, poetry workshops, sometimes just for people who want a medium through which to express themselves, sometimes as a form of executive education because it helps people to think differently. But absolutely fundamental to that is that sense of, I can be in a room and write a poem or listen to other people's poems and connect on quite a deep level quite quickly. And no, it isn't embarrassing. It actually brings us together more deeply and more quickly. And, you know, I'll be honest and say that on some level, when I first started noticing these things, I was a little skeptical. I thought, well, you know, is this real? Do people mean it? So, of course, I did what I should have done, which was go along and try it out. And I was absolutely blown away. I mean, I spend my life with words. I can't draw at all. I got cornered into a drawing workshop, you know, deeply resistant, deeply anxious, and made to go off and, you know, draw something in Kew Gardens, which is where this workshop was taking place. I was just amazed by the different quality of thinking I was able to access in my own head. And then amazed by some of the truly fantastic things that my colleagues had drawn. It changed the way we related to each other. No question about it. And it wasn't about judgment. It wasn't about whose is better. It's like, wow, I never saw it that way. You know, this is the whole value of social intelligence, which is being able to see the world in multiple different ways instead of being imprisoned by our single mindset. And I think, you know, you've written about this so brilliantly. It is how organizations and individuals become very inventive. It's what makes them deeply resilient. It is the greatest core competence any organization can develop. You know, you can layer as many skills on top of that as you like, but without that, what I call mortar, you know, that kind of social glue, you really can't get anything done very well or very easily or in any kind of sustainable fashion. So it's important to think about painting or music or words really as just different languages. And to the degree that we are comfortable with them, we can communicate better and more and come up with better ideas when confronted by complete surprises.
That's a wonderful note to almost end on. And just to say, I completely, completely understand what you're saying about the power of actually drawing, however good you are at it. We did a series of workshops in the V&A and with the wonderful Leo Crane, and we got people very, very simply with a piece of charcoal in pairs to draw one another's faces. And the conversation that came out as a result of that, I've never really looked at you before. I've never really seen you. And I've worked with you for 8 years, 10 years. And the conversations that came from that were so powerful just from that simple thing. But I'm going to ask to, you know, I know you're an optimist. I know you look for ideas, but you also look for solutions. I hate that word, but for ways forward, for you don't throw up your hands. And I wonder if you can leave us with something hopeful. I don't know, either that you learn from writing the book, one thing that we can do, one piece of wisdom maybe that really stuck in your brain. You often begin a talk by saying something stuck in my brain and it you know, I couldn't let it go. And then I worked on it. Something that came to you as a result of these incredible conversations in the writing of your book.
Well, there are a couple. I think the first thing is working on my book persuaded me absolutely unequivocally that as much as we may dislike uncertainty, we would truly hate a life of complete certainty. Because if everything in our life from now to the day I drop dead were certain, I would have no choices and no freedom. So beware of what you wish for. It's in uncertainty that there's opportunity. It's in uncertainty that there's a chance of discovery. It's in uncertainty that we learn about ourselves and other people. There's a reason why artists and scientists both move towards uncertainty, because they know that's the open ground in which discoveries are going to be made about oneself, about one's organization, about one's life, one's country, whatever it may be. So I think the really crucial thing I came to see was that we are being sold a lot of ideas and products and ways of living and being that purport to offer certainty, but beware too much of it. You won't like it if you get it.
That was a warning, but that was a beautifully put warning. And we're going to end on that. And thank you so much, dear Margaret. And thank you to those people who've listened to this conversation. As ever, there are links in the show notes to Margaret's books and talks. And please do get in touch if you have reflections on any of the topics that we've discussed today.